Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
This is All Football Commons Haters Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports.
Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
Alex Crook from TalkSport, a national newspaper reporter.
Also this week we'll be joined by the BT Sport and former ITV anchorman Matt Smith.
I'll be revealing which member of Manchester United royalty was swanning around in the Stamford Bridge tunnel after the Red Devils had sent Chelsea crashing out of the FA Cup, and offer some startling Sarri stats.
And find out why Frank Lampard left me raging at Brighton on Saturday.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Hello, yes, welcome along. We'll also be revealing the origins of another famous football term in our new weekly feature, which is called The Language of Love. I really feel like we should have started that in Valentine's week, guys.
We sort of did, didn't we? Well, it was sort of last week, wasn't it? That was Valentine's week. Yeah,
yeah. I think,
hold on, that was why we started it, wasn't it? You know, let's try and make out that this was planned. That sounds like a good idea.
I don't think Matterface is feeling the love for Maurizio Sarri this morning. More on that later. But no, looking forward to that. Did you guys know, by the way, we're coming of age this week? We are 21 episodes old today.
Oh, that's good. Oh. I'm sitting here at Stamford Bridge. The sun is shining and everyone's feeling very miserable.
Oh, dear.
As Crook has alluded to, right, I'm in a real mood. I've been away on the road. You know what it's like when you're a commentator or a reporter. Sometimes you have to go on these long, winding journeys up and down the country. I left my house, my little baby, on Thursday morning last week, right? And I haven't been back home since. It's now, what, Tuesday? I just want to go home. And since I've been away, I've had a partially dislocated shoulder. I've fallen over at the ice rink, and the football team that I've followed since I was 5 years of age have got progressively worse by the moment.
All those coal miners
such a hard
are feeling
life.
Your pain at the moment.
I was going to say.
Really, I'm not having a go about watching football. I love watching football, and I'm delighted about it. I'm just tired. I may have had a couple of extra beers with Sags last night, and I'm irritable.
I had a couple of beers last night as well, but for very different reasons.
Of course you did.
Well, I'll carry this podcast then, as you're both dramatically hungover. Let's talk about the FA Cup. It was a brilliant weekend. So, apart from being a Chelsea fan and Sam, let's take a look at the main talking points in numbers.
The Geek Sheet, this week in numbers.
Wolverhampton Wanderers ended Bristol City's hopes of claiming a sixth Premier League Cup scalp since the start of last season, the first time the men from the Black Country have reached the quarterfinals as a top flight side since way back in 1981.
Brighton are also through to the last eight for the second season running, having only reached this stage in two of their previous 102 attempts.
Millwall are the lowest ranked team left in the competition. The Lions have now reached four quarterfinals in the last 15 years. That's one up on Liverpool.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer produced a tactical masterclass to lead Manchester United to 2-0 triumph at Chelsea. The Red Devils have now won away at Stamford Bridge, Arsenal and Spurs for the first time in the same season since 1984-85.
Yeah, and during that match, Maurizio Sarri made the same substitution, Kovacic for Ross Barkley or vice versa again. Do you know that's the 20th time this season that his team have made that substitution? Talk about predictable, although he says it isn't. They only managed two shots on target in the whole game, and both of them came in the 11th minute of the match.
It's amazing how negative Sarri is. If he could have done, I'm sure Sarri would have brought Kovacic back on. It was certainly a contrasting night for you two then. Crook, have you finished floating yet? Should that say gloating?
Well, I think it should say gloating, but I am floating as well. Listen, it was a fantastic performance, wasn't it? After what happened against Paris Saint-Germain last week, Sam will tell you privately I was quite critical of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I thought he made the big decisions and got the wrong in that game. But it was a tactical masterclass last night. He knew exactly how to stop Chelsea playing, as in fairness, most teams do, because basically you just stop Jorginho playing out from midfield.
Yeah.
And they have no plan B. So they basically man-marked Jorginho and kicked him as much as they could last night, and then used the pace of the likes of Rashford and Lukaku on the counter-attack, and it worked to perfection. And in the second half, it was just about game management, keeping the ball. But I've got to say, Sarri is a baffling chap, isn't he? I mean, he makes the same changes game after game, whatever the situation. Therefore, he's making no effort to alter the course of history from the sidelines. And I think that change last night, bringing on Zappa Costa, what was he thinking? Is he trying to get himself fired?
It was fascinating being in the tunnel and talking to both managers, and spoke to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer afterwards, and I thought he did brilliantly. I thought Manchester United started the game really well, and he said, you know, we started the game really well. Then we suffered a little bit without the ball for a while, but we reacted brilliantly to that. Scored on the counter-attack, got two quick goals, and then knew how to manage the game. I said to him, it was when you were devising your game plan, did you believe that you could execute it so well? He said, you know what, we almost executed it perfectly. Maybe just a couple more goals would have made it even better. But, you know, they've obviously seen Chelsea, done their homework, plotted, come up with a plan and done it. And that's what every decent team is doing to Chelsea at the moment. And the definition of insanity is if you keep trying to do the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, you are a little bit cray-cray.
Last night when you chatted to him then, does he seem under pressure? Because he's almost, he's not blasé in interviews, but he seems to use the language thing to his advantage. More. I think he probably understands more than he lets on.
Well, he did take a long time to come out last night, but I think that was a tactic, like you say, to avoid the interviews going out before the live BBC One show ended, because BBC were on air till 10 and they had the draw to fit in. So he just sort of waited a little bit, let Ole Gunnar Solskjaer go out, and then just came out later because he knew that he was the focus of attention. When he did come out, he spoke like one of those mad cult preachers who just keep telling you, don't worry, everything's fine, just follow me over this here cliff. We'll just keep walking and it'll be fine. Even if we fall off that edge, it's fine, don't worry, just trust me. I did ask him a few sort of searching questions, including, are your team tactically predictable? And his response was, I don't know how to really categorise it, because he just said Manchester City play that way. Then waited and said the only difference is that Manchester City are top of the league. Now, again, it's not his first language, but we had a few awkward moments. You say that he understands more than maybe he lets on. I said commiserations and he had to have that translated. And again, I wonder whether that was a tactic. Is he stopping me from going in hard? Because I had to say the same sort of inline three times to try and get into the interview, because he was interrupting, trying to get a definition from his translator as to what that first word was. I don't know. But I do know this. I spoke to someone from the Chelsea camp last night, and they said that change right at the end not only annoyed the supporters, this is the Azpilicueta for Zappa Costa one, not only annoyed the supporters, but baffled the players as well. And when that starts to happen, and the crowd are blowing, Chelsea didn't play that bad in the first half. They actually played all right. They just can't score goals. And that is the big issue here, right? Because in the first few months of the season, they scored 27 goals in 11 fixtures. Pretty impressive. Everything was going well. No one had worked out, if you just sit on Jorginho, then you can stop Chelsea. As soon as everybody did work that out, Chelsea have scored 18 goals in the subsequent 16 games. 18 goals in 16 games. And they've drawn blanks against Bournemouth, Manchester City, against Manchester United and against Arsenal in massive games recently, which they've all lost. So
no plan B.
And he's never going to change it.
I did the Malmo game for TalkSport. A couple of interesting things there. First of all, in the pre-match press conference, Bruce Buck sat in as Maurizio Sarri was quizzed by the assembled media. I thought that was really telling. Maybe you can tell us, Sam, how common practice that is. He brought on N'Golo Conte in that game, and he had the opportunity, because of the personnel on the pitch, to play Conte in his preferred position, in the more deeper line midfield role. And despite that, he still insisted on playing him further forward. It's just so stubborn, isn't it?
I think the interesting thing is that Bruce Buck thing that you mentioned. A lot of people try to make a lot of that he came to the pre-match press conference. Bruce does this quite a lot, actually. He comes over from the other side of the pitch after a home game, and he'll go around the back of the dressing room area, come right back out the other side, and stand at the back of the press conference. Now, people like me who have done their interviews in the tunnel and then have vacated and come to watch the press conference, as I did last night, will notice that Bruce lurks in the background quite a lot in those. But if you're a journalist who sits in the first two or three rows down at the front by the table where the manager is sitting, you don't see Bruce Buck at the back of the room because you don't look that way. So
don't notice him, yeah.
It does happen more often than you'd think. I think more interestingly was the fact that Bruce Buck went to the side of the pitch prior to the start of the game and watched the warm-ups. That was a sort of message of this. We are watching, by the way. You know, don't think because the owner hasn't been to a game since he didn't get his visa that we've lost interest. We haven't. We're still watching.
Does Sarri do the warm-up normally? Because often head coaches and managers don't do the warm-up.
No.
To put it bluntly.
Right, let's put aside Maurizio Sarri and Chelsea and let's do this.
Oh my God, an insane goal!
The language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
Yeah, we did this last week and it proved pretty popular on Twitter. Darren from Hull sent us a suggestion. United got one of these last night. Chelsea seemed to be offering them up to big teams regularly. Clean sheets. Do you know where it came from? Got any ideas? Clean sheets?
I want to say toilet paper. I don't know why.
I'm going to say, although I'll reveal answers later, that's not it. Any ideas? Crook?
I haven't got a clue, I don't think.
No, okay, we'll stick around because we'll tell you before the end of the programme, after we've chatted with the former ITV Champions League host, the current BT Sport cricket, boxing, Champions League, Europa League host, Matt Smith. He's coming next.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Well, it's time to welcome this week's special guest geek. I'm delighted to say joining us is a man who spent more than 14 years presenting on ITV's Champions League coverage and now anchors football and boxing on BT Sport, as well as hosting the Tour de France. He's a busy man. Matt Smith, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you all?
Very good, thank you. Cheers for coming on the podcast.
Matt.
Really appreciate it. Matt, listen, obviously this is a very Stamford Bridge, Maurizio Sarri-orientated podcast this morning. As someone who speaks fluent Italian in the most beautiful way, could you please tell me what Sarissimo or Sarri Ball is in Italy? Because we haven't got a clue over here.
No. Well, it's getting more complicated and less impressive by the week, isn't it, by the game. I think it's fair to say he's a bit of a conundrum, Maurizio Sarri, in the sense that he only really has had success as a coach with Napoli. I think that's fair to say. I know he had sporadic periods, small periods of success before that with lower league teams. But actually, he's only really flourished at the top level with Napoli. And that was with a team that he built. He was given the time and patience to build and recruit and impress upon all of those players exactly how he wanted them to play. He didn't rotate much. I'm sure you've had a lot of this conversation already. And eventually it did produce results, but only for that period that he was at Napoli. So it was a big decision from Chelsea to decide that he was the way forward, given Chelsea's MO for the last, 15 years under Roman Abramovich. It doesn't really fit the idea of patience, time, construction, players buying into a manager's or coach's philosophy. So I think this was always riddled with potential problems.
I've got a question for you, away from sort of Maurizio Sarri, who we've seemingly talked about for a lot of this podcast. I know you were with ITV for quite a while and you left there when your contract ended. You're now freelance. So do you find any clashes between perhaps anchoring on BT Sport and doing stuff for ITV and other outlets? Or are they all quite relaxed about you working for what perhaps some might see as rivals?
Well, I think that landscape for broadcasters has changed a lot in the last few years. So I think there is more freedom, I think, for a number of reasons. I think that suits kind of both sides of the equation, if you like. I think for the broadcasters, it's become a cheaper way to use people. And they'd be more open-minded towards talent share, which means they can, I suppose, use better people or the people they feel are best suited to the roles they have. There are still some obstacles. For instance, you can't really work, I don't think, for BT Sport and for Sky Sports. I certainly can't. I don't think anybody else can. And I think there's probably something of a similar divide between Five Live Sport and Talk Sport on the radios. Sam, Alex and myself and others would know. But actually, I think broadly, it's been a positive thing. I think it gives more opportunity to people. And that's how it should be. I think it's obviously the landscape has grown as well in terms of the number of broadcasters that have sporting rights. And I think that's it's been a healthy place to work, really, in recent years.
Matt, I mentioned your CV there and the wide variety of sports that you have covered or do still cover. I've also read a couple of interviews with you in which you're almost described as a bit of a jack of all trades. Does it annoy you that you haven't really ever been seen as the main man at any one particular company? And how big a blow was it to you when Adrian Charles left ITV that you didn't get that job?
No, I don't really see it in those terms, I've got to be honest, Alex. I don't think it's necessarily about being given one opportunity. I'm grateful, to be honest, for all the chances I get to work across different sports, across different broadcasters. I think it's such a competitive business. You're kind of waiting for the day when they realise you're not that good and they get somebody else full stop. So I think I don't take any of it for granted. I work hard at being the best I can be and trying to be someone that is easy and helpful to work with. I see myself very much as part of a team. All the places that I've worked, I've always tried to maintain that disposition. I think that's important. I think if you get caught up in kind of wrestling for some kind of top spot, whether that's even a thing or not, I think I'm not sure that's necessarily to your credit as a person or a broadcaster. So I think it's a jigsaw puzzle making a radio or a TV show, and that's how I've always seen it. So I'm part of a team, and I think successful teams make successful programs, really.
Yeah, and Matt's, I'll just let you in a secret, guys. Matt's got a very good reputation amongst TV broadcasters and production teams as being the person they would love to work with because he is so easy to work with, and you only have to ask him to do something once, and he just does it, and he comes to all the production meetings, he doesn't cause a fuss, and he just gets the job done. You've got such a rich tapestry of great events to do. But how exciting was it going on the road with Ronnie O'Sullivan?
Yeah, that was a different one. It came out of the blue, that. I mean, you're right. I have had the luck of going to some extraordinary events. That was something that I'd worked on snooker, luckily enough, with Ronnie. And we seemingly got on reasonably well. And as a result of that, he phoned me up. I was actually at an FA Cup game between Shrewsbury and Man United. sat on the touchline watching this kind of slightly uneventful game. My phone went and I saw it was him. I thought I'd better answer it. So I had a slightly halting conversation because I was in a football ground. But he said, look, there's this kind of program idea about trolling across America, playing pool. I need kind of someone to hold my hand. Would you do it? And that was it. And I was like, well, sounds quite fun. And it was a program that kind of evolved as it went. So we basically spent a month in four cities just dreaming up places and people and ideas to throw together to make a kind of I don't know what it was, really. It was a kind of tour of the States, a kind of pool-based conversation, culture, geography, type travel, whatever it was. It was a kind of hodgepodge of things that somehow think people liked, really. So, yeah, I don't know what else to say about it.
Matt, the Champions League is obviously off terrestrial television at the moment, and I've spoken to a few people about this, and obviously BT Sport have the rights, but do you think there's perhaps a danger of sort of a whole generation of fans now, youngsters that perhaps don't have satellite television, that could be missing out on watching the Champions League? Because there's not, you know, I know you used to be involved with ITV and all the things they did with the highlights, but there's not even the highlights on television anymore. So how important do you think it is that the Champions League is accessible?
Yeah, I've got to be careful what I say, haven't I, given that I'm doing a highlight for Sport on the Champions League just this week. But listen, I think there's two sides very much to that. Argument. I think sport of this kind of scale and magnitude and importance in lots of ways should be available to as many people as possible. Of course it should. That's how we include fans. That's how we include potential players of tomorrow. We should all be able to enjoy these big events together as much as possible. But they have these sports, obviously with their success, in some ways priced themselves out of the the grip of a lot of people at home. So that is the market forces at work, if you like. And I suppose that the concept of subscription television, and then even obviously now pay-per-view television, particularly with boxing, is seemingly coming ever more to the fore. We've seen attempted streaming models this last season or two, and that may continue. Obviously, Amazon look like they're going to make strides into not just tennis, but football, and who knows how big those strides will become. We've heard in the last couple of weeks from presidents and big football clubs and major stakeholders talking of, again, an evolution of the Champions League into something more akin to a European Super League of sorts that might even be played at the weekends in years to come. So I think we are not done yet. We are far from having arrived at a point that this is how it will work for years to come. Now, whether that will, to some extent or any extent, include the whole population in a free-to-air way, I don't know. I doubt we can put the genie back in the bottle in that way, because I think money in the end talks, whether you like that or not. But there might be a way in which you can pay for what you want rather than being asked to fork out large amounts for things of which only a part you really want to see. I think that it might splinter in that way, because that's perhaps more sustainable and eventually becomes more achievable for those of us that want to watch Man United or Liverpool, or for that matter, Stoke, Shrewsbury or whoever. We might get access to those pictures and that production.
Matt, when we worked together at TalkSport on the World Cup last summer, I vividly remember how excited you were about covering the upcoming Tour de France, which is a really unique event, I would imagine, from a broadcast perspective. How was that for you, and how much extra preparation did you have to do going into that?
Yeah, that has been something I've really enjoyed the last couple of years. I have been a cycling fan for quite a while. Myself and Ned Bolting obviously worked together at ITV with Sam. Both been cycling fans. Ned worked on it for a number of years now. So when the opportunity arose to do a small part of what is a big job for ITV on the Tour de France in the summer, I jumped at the chance, because I love the race. I love the stories it throws up. Actually, I think it's one of those races and one of those sports, road cycling, where the more you kind of invest in the detail of what's going on, the more you understand and the more enjoyable it becomes to be part of that spectacle as a viewer, because actually there is a lot going on. It looks at a glance that there's just 200-odd blokes powering down the road on bikes and nothing much happens to the last couple of minutes. But actually there's a lot of teamwork, tactics, there's a lot of nuance that is really interesting to get your teeth into when you understand it a bit better. And obviously our job is to try and get some of that across to the viewer, because a lot of these stages are 4 and 5 hours long. But as I said, there's a lot to get your teeth into on the road during the day and around the race and the sport of cycling. For pluses and minuses, obviously it's had a lot of its problems, I think it's fair to say, with doping and the domination of Sky and sponsorship and whether the sport is run as well as it could be. There's a lot of talking points around cycling, but it doesn't make it, for me, any less of a draw as a sport. It's a great thing to work on. So, you know, hopefully that may continue.
Okay, finally, before we let you go, you have been seen as a little bit of a housewife's favourite in the Des Lynam Silver Fox type mode. You're a very charming man. What's the strangest bit of fan mail you've ever received?
Blimey. Well, I don't get as much as I used to, that's for sure, and that's probably a good thing. Yeah, there's been probably one or two down the years. I don't know whether I would remember all the details or the things that were in the envelopes, to be honest, I think the bottom line is it's flattering for anybody to take the trouble to write in or get in touch, as they do now. They don't really write in anymore, do they? But they do contact you on social media, obviously, and other ways to say either that they love you, hate you, or something in between. I suppose you don't want to kind of be ignored. I'm not really that bothered about whether people like or dislike what I do from a public's point of view. You don't want to be hated, but I think ultimately you kind of are the best judge of whether you've done a good job or not. So I don't tend to see that as a barometer. But it's nice that people get in touch to say that they like what you did or that they thought the programme was good. But if you're going to take that, then you have to take the few that also get in touch to say you could have done this better or you could have done that better. But it's not easy, you know. Sometimes, you know, as we all know, you say things in the spur of the moment and you try and describe things and you come up with a line that you hope encapsulates what's just happened, and it's rarely good and it's probably never perfect. So it's a question of doing your best, but the beauty of that is that when it's finished, you can take your earpiece out and wipe your face clean and go home.
Matt,
didn't you
thank you very much.
Unless you're covered in lipstick.
That never happens. That never happens.
Matt, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming on and giving us the time. And we'll see you soon on the Champions League or the cricket or with Ronnie O'Sullivan or doing the boxing or something very soon.
As long as it's something, Sam. As long as it's something.
Great stuff.
What a headshot!
It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
Yeah, let's look at some of our experiences from being in tunnels over the weekend up and down the country at Football League and Premier League grounds. I was at Stamford Bridge last night when Sir Alex Ferguson came walking through with three minders. It was like that scene at the beginning of a Star Wars A New Hope where Darth Vader walks in. Duh, 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 and everyone just parts out the way. And Fergie walks down the tunnel celebrating a Manchester United victory at Stamford Bridge. And I was sort of sitting there going, oh, welcome back. He was all smiles, though. So as you would expect after that performance last night. Michelle, where were you?
I was, first of all, midweek, I was at Bristol City v QPR. Fantastic finish to that game. Came down the tunnel and there was a lot of choice words and shouting. And I was scuttling down the tunnel rather quickly.
Who from?
And I turned around to see the very red face of Steve McLaren following me down, not in the best of moods. And I had to hold the door open for him. Needless to say, I didn't get a thank you for that one. And yeah, saw a few things which I probably can't repeat from that tunnel as well. And then on Saturday, I was on the most difficult gantry in the world, potentially. I don't know if you guys have been here, Exeter City.
Yeah.
And when you climb up Exeter City's gantry, you have to have one arm on the ladder and then hoist yourself up one arm onto a wooden platform. That's all it is. It's a bit of scaffolding hanging from the roof and it hangs down. And when you get onto the gantry, there's probably about 10-15 people on it and you've no idea how it's holding all their weight, and they have sort of yellow foaming that you sometimes see on building sites which they've put across the top of the scaffolding so you don't whack your head. Even I at 5'5" need that foam because you do tend to whack your head. But that's as exciting as it got, because Exeter v Bury was a bit of a dull game, to the point at half time I had to climb down, request for the ladder to be put down, because that's what you have to do, because they hoist the ladder up and they put it back down if you need the toilet or you need to go down. You can't go down during time when the game is being played because there's people underneath. But I had to go and find myself a very strong coffee to keep me awake for the second half. Where were you, Crook?
Well, I was at Brighton on Saturday, and as I think we've touched on in the past, there's a big push at TalkSport at the moment, led by our baby-faced producer, Declan McCarthy, to get players and managers on for live interviews immediately after the game. Now, we have an ISDN point in the tunnel at Brighton, which is unusual. We don't have that at too many of our grounds. So I knew I would be expected to deliver on this at the weekend. I did get Anthony Knockhart pretty quickly, which was great, even though I lost a coin toss with Rob Nothman of the BBC to decide which of us went first. I did try and cheat, actually, because I thought I'd seen how his coin had landed on the top of his hand, but I got that one wrong. Anyway, so we did that. And then Frank Lampard appeared soon after. So I thought, right, happy days here, I'm in. Frank proceeded to do two TV interviews, one for the BBC and one for Kerry Brown at beIN Sport, and then spent the next 15-20 minutes talking to a mate of his in one corner of the tunnel. Now, because we had a 3 p.m. kickoff, and of course Brighton was 12:30, that meant we missed our window to get Frank live on the air before they threw to the commentary of the Wimbledon-West Ham game. I was so annoyed. I mean, in fairness, he was really polite and courteous when he did finally come over, but I was smiling through gritted teeth throughout the whole interview because he wouldn't have kept Match of the Day waiting like that, would he?
He might have done. It depends who you're interviewing. It's great down there in that Brighton tunnel, I think. I think it's really well fitted out and very well organised. And Brighton are very good at getting you the people you want very quickly. I must admit, I've only had positive experiences down there. I've done Pep Live in the tunnel. The other week I mentioned it on the pod, Dyche and Houghton, very quickly after the end of the game. I think they're very good at doing that. And I think that's great. And when you say ISDN, for people who don't know what that is, that's a broadcast point. So we can plug in our actual live broadcasting equipment in a different area of the stadium. Usually you're sort of anchored to the press box where you do your game from or your reports from. But being able to be mobile, I think, is something that we want to try and do. I know that and you talked about the baby-faced assassin, Deck, who looks a little bit like the Count from Sesame Street, our producer.
A lot.
I've been working with him to try and sort of get some radio mic equipment invested in that to try and to give the whole product a bit more mobility so we can move around a little bit more and do more interviews and just capture the colour. One of the things I sort of spoke to him about was even something I learned from Dancing on Ice, let's go around the whole stadium. Let's be in different. Let's bring the whole experience to the broadcast, because this is stupid, but you'll get what I mean. When we do the Dancing on Ice program on a Sunday, it's television, so you can see. But Phil and Holly, who present it, they move round, so they'll be in different parts of the studio. So you get a perspective of what the whole rink looks like and what it's like to be in that studio. And I think we need to do that with a football match. We need to be in different parts of the ground, especially in big games, to express just where we are and how it sounds down in this part and what it's like over in this area, and try and give a sort of 360 display of what's happening inside that event.
On the subject of movement, I do have an issue at Brighton, because my headphones, the cable, is not long enough for someone who's 6'5" to actually stand up and do the interviews. So there was an occasion the other week when I was plugged into the point and I was almost on my knees interviewing Chris Hughton. So, Dec, if you're listening, I need a longer cable for my headset.
Just to say, I've just got an image of Crook now, just sort of crouching
on his knees,
killing him, trying to interview Chris Hughton. Anyway, get that image out of my head. I heard you at Newport on Saturday doing Newport v Man City. I listened to the first half when I was driving home, and I love the fact that you sent Lawrence out into the crowd, or sort of just in front of the fans. It was just a nice little another element and a little break from Ian Holloway and all his Ian Holloway-isms, just to bring something else to it. And by the way, I thought you and Ian worked fantastically together.
He really is a great guy. He's very funny. He's you have to live on your nerves a little bit, because you never know what he's going to say next.
I can tell you're a little bit on edge, but it was really enjoyable. And I came home and, sorry for you, I watched the second half. But listening to the first half, I flicked between you and another station doing the commentary. And you were my station of choice genuinely, Sam. I thought it was really, really excellent.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say.
Oh, my God, an insane goal!
The language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
Come on then, Sam. Clean sheets. It's not about toilet paper, is it? What word is it? Where does this come from?
Okay, well, I thought Crook might know this, because it actually comes from the journalistic profession. So in the old days, Crook will tell you now, when you're doing a report, maybe you do this as well, Michelle, you get your page of A4 or your notepad page, and you put a line through the middle and you write events that happen for team A on the left side, and on the other side you write events for team B. Well, in the old days, they did a sheet each. So you had one sheet of paper for team A and one sheet of paper for team B. And when team B didn't score in a game, then no one would write anything down. So they would have a
clean sheet.
There you go. And that's where
I should have known that, really, shouldn't I?
Started from, and it sort of came into natural parlance after over time, and it just got adopted by the football fraternity. But yeah, that's where it came from. So it's a journalistic-inspired football piece of terminology. So there
we
are.
We should throw this open to the listeners now, if they want to have a particular phrase that they're not sure about where it emanated from. Get in touch at AFC Geeks are our handles on Twitter and Instagram. Maybe set Sam a challenge in the coming weeks.
Find this out, Matterface. Do some more work.
Yeah. Yeah, stop falling in the ice and do some proper work. Right, that's all we have time for this week. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. The handles are exactly the same at AFC Geeks. And do join us again next week.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.